is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
I had a third grade teacher who went above and beyond what she needed to do to look out for a student that she had just met. You know, she made the effort to call her mother and to give me the extra help. You know, I remember there are times when she would stay after school and give me the extra help. So the fact that I turned around and became a teacher, you know, many years later, and I taught in the classroom for 12 years is no surprise when I look back and understand that I'm a product of someone who has received much. So, you know, that's one thing, you know, to give back. I think it's a responsibility that we all should take seriously.
Marshall Cho was hired on May 1st, 2015 as the head boys basketball coach for Lake Oswego High School in the state of Oregon. Cho served as the director of basketball operations at University of Portland from 2012 to 2014. His primary responsibilities included coordinating the team's travel plans, office management, overseeing the program's community outreach efforts, and managing the pilot basketball camps. Cho joined the Pilots after spending the previous three seasons on the coaching staff at renowned DeMatha Catholic High School in Hyattsville, Maryland, with Coach Mike Jones. Cho began his career as an educator through the Teach for America program and taught in the South Bronx and Harlem for 6 years. He served as the boys' basketball coach from 2004 to 2006 at Future Leaders Institute, leading them to a New York City charter school championship. From 2006 to 2009, while living in Mozambique, Cho spent 3 years as a volunteer coach and instructor with the Mozambican National Basketball Federation. Cho worked to assist the under-20 and under-16 national team and for one of the top senior men's club teams in Mozambique. He also trained under-16 basketball coaches using the NBA Nike Africa Coaches Guide for six consecutive weekends leading up to the under-16 national championship. In August of 2008, Cho was the varsity boys basketball coach at the American International School of Mozambique, where he started and developed that program. During his time in Africa, Cho served as a coach for the NBA-sponsored Basketball Without Borders of Africa. He also led a variety of volunteer efforts, including rehabilitating basketball courts by partnering with Hoops for Hope and the U.S. Embassy, while conducting basketball clinics with local basketball clubs. Cho has served as a clinician for USA Basketball's youth division and worked as a court coach and support staff member for the Junior National Team program. He has worked with USA Basketball for the Nike Hoop Summit game since 2012, as well as working the Junior National Team's U16 and U17 trials. Cho graduated from the University of Oregon with a bachelor's degree in business administration in 2000. He also received a master's degree in secondary mathematics education from Columbia University in 2003. Cho was born in Seoul, South Korea, and grew up in Springfield, Oregon. Make sure you tell your coaching friends about the Hoopheads Pod and leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to the show. Help us grow the great game of basketball by sharing your favorite episode with a colleague or fellow coach. Grab your notebook and get ready to be inspired by the story of Coach Marshall Cho from Lake Oswego High School in the state of Oregon.
Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel. And tonight we are pleased to welcome to the podcast from Lake Oswego High School in Oregon, Marshall Cho. Marshall, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, we're excited to have you on the show tonight, get a chance to learn more about some of the unique things that you've had an opportunity to do in the game. I think people out there are going to be very interested to hear some of the stories that you have to tell. And we're going to start by going back to your childhood and talk a little bit about how you got into the game of basketball when you were young.
Yeah, I was born and raised in South Korea. I immigrated to Springfield, Oregon in 1986. I was almost 10 years old at the time. Grew up with baseball and soccer as my two favorite sports. But I was fortunate enough, the neighborhood that I moved into, there was a basketball court in the public park across the street from where I grew up. So fell in love with the game around fourth grade. You know, it was one of those sports where I could do it by myself. At the time, again, my parents were just making their way as immigrants, and we couldn't afford to play baseball, or, you know, the soccer season came, you know, in the fall and in the spring. But all the rest of the time that I had, you know, free on my hands, I ended up falling in love with the game. And here I am, you know, many years later, having coached, going into my 15th year as a coach.
What was the adjustment like for you moving from South Korea here to the United States, both in terms of just your life in general and then, you know, getting into school and figuring out the language barrier and all those things? Talk a little bit about that experience of coming to a new country.
You know, I was really fortunate. I was in a situation where I moved in February in Korea. The school year runs the calendar year from January to January. So I had actually completed third grade by the time I'd come over, and we had a debate whether I should move forward to fourth grade or repeat the second half of third grade. I ended up repeating the second half. I still remember to this day, my teacher, Mrs. Kingman, she invited her mother, who was also a retired teacher. So in addition to receiving the, you know, back in the day, we used to call it ESL, right? Now it's ELL,
right. But
English is second language. I had an ESL class for an hour and a half a day. In addition, I had this retired teacher who would take me for another hour and a half. So in terms of language acquisition, it took me about 6 months, and I was up and running. But I do remember that, again, I mentioned before, soccer was my favorite sport. And, you know, from my game at that point was more advanced than, you know, the kids in the schoolyard. So when they saw that I was one of the better soccer players, they were quick to gravitate towards me. And that was a lesson learned early on that sports, if you're had some gift in it, or if you were proficient in it, you know, you can use that to your social advantage, I suppose. So that was a lesson learned. And at the same time, you know, I was really just fortunate to have a group of, you know, classmates who took me in and welcomed me into the community. It was really the ideal childhood growing up in Springfield, Oregon.
What was your most vivid memory from basketball in that first year or so that you were here in the United States? What was one of the most vivid memories you had at that time from the game?
Yeah, that's a good question, Mike. You're good at this. it's a question I haven't really been asked before. It took me about a year until I, you know, mustered up the courage to even go out to the courts, you know, to interact with the other kids who were playing. Obviously, I was new to the game, so I didn't really know what I was doing. But I wouldn't say any particular instance in those early few years stand out, but I do remember the same, you know, just looking at the you know, when the high school guys would come and play, or the college and older guys would come and play pickup. Again, we're dating ourselves, right? This is, you know, 1987, where
right.
People still played on the blacktop. So
for sure,
I was in the fourth grade, but I remember, you know, before those games would, let's say they would pick up from like 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. right? So if you're a grade school kid, you can get on there for a couple hours before the big boys showed up. So I do remember the times, you know, where that transition was happening. The older guys sometimes would take me aside and, you know, show me how to shoot or play one-on-one with me. And that's something that, you know, stands out to me to this day when I see my own high school guys, you know, when we run a camp or a clinic, that they turn around and do that for our kids in our community. It just happens to take place in the high school gym rather than the blacktop. As our coach, I'm happy and thankful to witness it. But I know that, you know, at least for me, like if I didn't have that, I don't know if that's, you know, maybe I would have picked another sport. But again, it's the same thing as I mentioned before in the classroom where I was taken in by a community. I was fortunate to experience that. Same thing on the basketball court. So, you know, the game, you know, was allowed to kind of, you know, it gave me time to fall in love with the game.
Yeah, I know that I say it all the time, but I feel like kids today have missed out on that whole playground basketball, pickup basketball culture that was so important to me in my development, not just as a basketball player, but just as a human being and figuring out how to interact with people of different ages. I can remember being 13, 14 years old and going up and just like you getting there early to try to get in the first game because, you know, once all the better players and older players showed up, then my chances of getting out on the court diminished. So I always wanted to make sure that I was there to be one of the first 10 guys to get on the court. So if my team would win, I'd have a chance of playing 2, 3, 4 games before I had to get off the court and go do something else. And just, I remember people taking me under my wing, you know, taking me under their wing from, again, adults who seemed like they were really old at the time, but they were probably 25, 26 years old. And then the high school kids from my community. And just, it was something that I think continues to have an impact on me today in terms of how I interact with people and just the comfort level that I have with people from all different walks of life, whether it be, you know, age, gender, race, whatever, all that stuff. I think you learn through the game and especially through pickup basketball more so than I think the system now, because you play with kids your own age and you play in a gym and there's always a coach there and parents. It's just not the same experience for kids. And there's obviously a lot of positives to the system today, but I feel bad for kids that they don't get to experience some of the things that it sounds like you got to experience and that I got to experience out on the playgrounds and just in, you know, open gym and being able to play that way. It's a totally different system today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you're saying it, it's really making me reflect on how often, you know, it is that our high school guys interact with our youth, you know, youth program kids. I don't want to jump the gun on, you know, the rest of the conversation that we'll have, but
no, let's jump into it for sure. Jump right into that.
We always talk about the ratio of practices to games in the state, in the country, right? You know, maybe in Europe and other places where the structure is already set, you have five practices to one game, or, you know, what I'm trying to touch upon is just the ratio to which these interactions happen, right? So when you and I are talking, reflecting on this, I think a lot of people lament the first thing that comes up in our conversation is usually, you know, you lose a game and you have to wait 3 hours to get back on. And I think the thing that I'm taking away from our conversation now is how as a high school coach, can I create an environment where that organic interaction is happening more than, let's say, for my program, as good as we are in terms of being involved with our youth program, let's say 20 times in a year, right? I mean, that's a month's worth of pickup ball that you and I experienced, right?
That's exactly.
The 12 months, you know. You know, in Oregon, it rains. The joke is that it rains 9 months out of the year, so it's 3 months of outdoor hoops anyways. I would imagine I probably spent 6 months out of the year in that setting in my early years. That's a pretty good ratio, you know, compared to what we're giving them now. So that's, as you're saying this, I'm going to go away from the interview and really be challenged to reflect on how more often I can, you know, create that interaction between the older and the younger guys in our own community.
Yeah. And it's always, I mean, I think it's a challenge because that's one of the things that you think about that as a high school coach. And I always maintain that people out there in the general public, whether that could be parents or whether that might be just people in the community, they don't always understand the amount of time and effort and energy that the high school coach puts in, not just with his or her varsity team, but also with, if you're going to have a successful program, you have to dip down into those younger levels to be able to touch those kids and build those relationships and build their skills and be able to have them feel like they're a part of the greater program. And that's one of the most fun things, Marshall, is to be able to talk to all these different guys and just hear how they engage with their youth program. Because a lot of what I do, just kind of the way it's happened, is a lot of the camps and things that I run here in Cleveland end up being for those younger elementary school kids. So I have a decided interest in just how people interact and do things with their youth basketball program. So it's interesting to hear you say that you're constantly reflecting and thinking about that. And talk a little bit about more what you do there in Lake Oswego with your, with your youth program.
We live in it's a two high school town. Each high school is about 1,200 students in population. So it's at the end of the day, a pretty small community. In our youth program, the way it's set up, we have our guys playing in a part of a league that feeds into their high school. So what's nice about it is the Three Rivers League that we have set up, our fourth graders, that's when they first start to wear Lake Oswego across their chest. Our in-city rival, Lake Ridge, on the other side of the lake, you know, it's the same thing. And then neighboring schools, you know, it's likewise. So in that sense, you know, from fourth grade to eighth grade on, there's, you know, during the season, there's continuity. There's, you know, there's the whole feeder system aspect of it. But what's been cool, at least for our community, is I came from, again, having been a director of basketball operations at University of Portland. So, you know, I had some experience being able to run a camp. That was part of my job requirement. Prior to that, you know, being at the Mathe Catholic for 3 years, you know, our summer camps were we would have hold five sessions, you know, so I had a lot of practice in running camps. So that's one of the major emphasis. I got this job in May and turned around and ran two camps in June, and the hustle was on, you know, definitely. But, you know, I got a chance to see our, you know, community kids from first grade on. So we just finished I just finished my fourth year here in the community at Lake Oswego. And it's funny you mentioned that. I think the timing of this is a challenge for me to continue to build and figure out a way to have more regular contact with our kids. We run camps in the off season. We run clinics, not to your extent, but, you know, hopefully we'll get there one day. But, you know, I think the next step probably is to, when we have our June summer league, extending that down to maybe seventh and eighth graders and having them have more exposure. It's one of the ideas that we thought about for this off season is that, we would have a seventh grade inner squad, you know, game where our high school guys are, you know, refereeing it, you know, running it. And then that evening is, you know, let's say that's a 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, you know, seventh grade and eighth grade scrimmage. Well, after that, it's seventh grade. We're, you know, or at 7 p.m. when we have our, you know, summer league game on a Wednesday night against a neighboring school, all those kids could stay behind and watch.
Right. You know,
part of the halftime talk. So
yeah.
It's really extending now from the top down, giving a more meaningful experience for the middle school kids, and then trying to figure out as much as possible how much exposure we get to the grade school kids.
So how do you go about working with not just the players, but how do you go about working with the youth coaches that are part of your program to make sure that they're teaching the things that you want to be teaching the kids, and that those coaches are also building relationships with the kids and then building that relationship with your program? How do you go about interacting with those youth level coaches?
Yeah. I don't know how other communities do it, but we have a coaching coordinator, we have a board president, or we have a youth board. I'm pretty fortunate in that our youth board of volunteers, we go about eight deep. So, you know, they'll serve 2 or 3 year terms and we'll cycle through. So we're in a transition of, you know, having brought in new board members this past year. But our coach coordinator is really great. He makes sure that, you know, any content, I share my practice plan, you know, is open. Our practices are open. You know, in terms of running a system, offense or defense, I'm actually not too strict about that. I want them to, at this point, I've given our youth coaches a lot of freedom to just kind of, you know, bring their own expertise into it. But moving forward, I do think for the success, the long-term success of the program, there needs to be more continuity. But our practices are open to coaches, you know, any clinics that we have, you know, we make sure we're providing, free entrance. You know, we cover the fees for any kind of local clinics that are happening for any of the coaches that want to go. We have on game nights, you know, our pregame, you know, locker room talk is open to our coaches at all times, and teams as well. So we've scheduled different teams over the course of this season to come in and listen to our pregame talk and sit behind the bench and try to make, again, if you're a part of our youth program, you know, their access to the high school it's pretty much an open door policy.
Yeah, that's awesome. Do you get a lot of coaches then that come up and watch practice?
You know, it's really hard. I don't know how other system, you know, other programs have set it up. I think we compensate pretty well. We have parent coaches in the fourth and fifth grade, but for sixth through eighth grade, we have paid, you know, coaches. But again, a lot of these coaches are, you know, people who hold full-time jobs as well, trying to, you know, fit in a coaching season. So to expect them to come to practice is, you know, it's pretty tough, but, you know, we make a conscious effort, at least in the eighth grade, to have our assistant coaches go out and observe practice. We make a conscious effort to have our, you know, we've had our varsity players go and show up to a practice. I think the challenge now is, like anything we do, it's the execution, consistent execution of making that happen for every team going all the way down to eighth grade. But, you know, last year I was really fortunate to have an assistant coach who also coached our top eighth grade team. And I think that's really the model that I want to take a look at, where, I can find additional compensation for that coach to come and be a part of our high school staff, you know, on the two other nights he's not holding practice. And that's worked out really well for us. One of our assistant coaches, Rob Smaller, I was listening to Gannon Baker's podcast, you know, just recently prepping for this. Rob has had a close relationship with Gannon. And so, you know, somebody of that caliber who's a really good coach, coached our top team, but then was also a player development coach at the high school 2 years ago. And so that eighth grade team, when they came up, you know, I got a chance to see that they were the most prepared freshman group that I've, you know, had in 4 years. You know, they go 23-1 this year in their freshman season. So it's no accident that when you have that kind of, you know, close relationship, continuity, it gave me a glimpse into what I need to be doing in the next, you know, phase of building this program.
So what does the player development coach role look like for your program? What does that guy do on a day-to-day basis? What does that look like?
For those people who maybe didn't listen to Gannon's interview or, you know, or aren't on Instagram, you know, following the numerous different, you know, player development coaches who are posting content on social media or, you know, other forms of media. What we were able to do was with this particular coach, you know, make sure that, again, this is a term that I borrowed from one of our alums, Dan Brady, who is now on the coaching staff with the Oklahoma City Thunder. But he came and watched our off-season workouts, and he asked me, "Have you ever heard of vitamin time?" And so I said, "What's that?" And it's something that's, you know, that happens in the league where, you know, usually it's after practice. You know, a player development coach will go and you know, take a player, and that player is, you know, one dictating, you know, the type of things that they want to work on during the season to stay sharp. So, you know, Coach Smaller, you know, after a full 2-hour practice, would oftentimes take 2 or 3 players, just even in during the season. You know, I think it's really important to keep developing, especially the younger players who aren't getting a lot of playing time. So we were able to make sure that they stayed sharp and ready for the moment when, you know, we had an injury or, you know, an illness or whatever, that they were ready to go.
Yeah, it's awesome that you have that capability to be able to have a guy like that on staff to be able to work out your guys after and get more time in on the court. You know, I know that everybody's always looking for ways to gain an edge and to help their players improve and to provide more value. And so the fact that you're able to do that, I would think that that would be a tremendous selling point for anybody who's involved in the program. But, you know, if I'm a kid who's player 10, 11, 12 on the end of the bench and I'm not getting to play very much, you know, the opportunity to work with somebody who cares about me and is going to help me get better throughout the season, I think that's got to be just a tremendous resource for you guys to have available year in and year out, day in, day out as part of your program.
Yeah. I mean, you know, it's funny. We just kind of skipped around real quick here, you know, growing up, you know, on free and reduced lunch in Springfield, Oregon, all the way to, you know, I mean, Lake Oswego High School, we have one of the highest, you know, per capita income in the state. A lot of our kids are able to, you know, have extra resources to, you know, get training help. I probably have the best, you know, strength and conditioning setup that I have right now, where I have a coach who helps, you know, me and our guys. Our weight room was recently renovated, you know, thanks to a generous donation from Kevin Love, who's an alum here. So, you know, a lot of this that I'm, you know, some high school coach that out there that might be listening might be in the same position I was, you know, when I go to a coaching clinic and listen to Coach Cal talk about how when he has 8 student managers out there,
right, you know, right,
to run his practice, and they're going, "What? Like, I don't have that." So, you know, some of that aspect, you know, it's humbling to realize that, you know, we are successful. We've been able to be successful in the last 2 years, winning our league, and, you know, this past season we were number one in state for the second half of the season. It's really, you know, that's a whole nother conversation to say, okay, I'm coaching at a school like this with all these resources. Well, I also came from, you know, 3 years in Africa where I didn't have any resources. And I had to be creative in how to run a practice for 40 kids with 2 basketballs. So, all that to say, you know, I know that I'm in a really fortunate position here, but, you know, as I tell my guys, you know, be thankful for the opportunities that you have. You know, for me, a personal challenge of mine has been to also reach out to other high school coaches and figure out a way to help them and serve them, you know, in ways that, you know, maybe if I have, you know, extra resources that I can share with them.
So what are some of those resources that you would share with people?
I'd be embarrassed. I'm sitting in my basketball office now, right now, just surrounded by just mountains of basketballs sitting here. Fortunate to have a sponsorship where we get a brand new basketball, six new basketballs every year that we don't even pay for. It could be a concrete resource like that, down to, any of the clinics that we go to. We're again trying to be an open book within our own program, but also outside. When I was living in Mozambique, one of the most meaningful things that I got to do was, when I would come back to the States, collecting, gently used basketball shoes or used jerseys and turning around and giving it to other, bringing it to the kids in Mozambique. We've done a couple of drives. Again, this isn't something I know now it's going public, but, it's something that we do just on our own without making it public. But when we do have the resources, I think it's just a matter of, how do we go about sharing that? How do we go about holding clinics that we can run, as fundraisers for other, programs or within both domestically and internationally.
Registration is now open at www.headstartbasketball.com for this summer's Head Start Basketball Camps. We'll be hosting camps this summer in Strongsville, Westlake, Avon Lake, Oberlin, Brunswick, Highland Heights, Mentor, and Hudson. At Head Start Basketball, we care deeply about making a positive impact on the lives of young basketball players, both on and off the court. It's through building strong relationships with our players, parents, and coaching staff that we are able to use the game of basketball to enrich the lives of those we interact with, both inside and outside of our organization. We believe that our attention to detail, our growth mindset, and our commitment to lifelong learning allows us to help our players achieve their fullest potential. We are passionately committed to providing players, parents, and coaches with everything they need to reach their goals. These core values run through everything we do. Check out our website, www.headstartbasketball.com, and discover why you should attend a Head Start Basketball Camp this summer. Hope to see you there.
To be able to have an impact on other people, I think, is something that just from what little I'd known of you and just reading your bio before we talked. And I think that it's clear that you have a desire to have an impact on people beyond just the game of basketball or using the game of basketball as your vehicle to be able to do that. And, a lot of people that sometimes get in those positions don't always necessarily look to do those things. So it's a credit to you that you're looking to be able to make an impact. And I think that's one of the things that, as we get older, and I know I'm speaking for myself here for sure, that as I've gotten older, being able to make those kinds of impacts has become a lot more important to me, and being able to touch more kids, be able to touch more players, be able to impact coaches. And that was at least some idea of why we decided to start doing the podcast, was to be able to sort of spread, our influence, but also give coaches like yourself and all the other great people that we've had on an opportunity to share some of the things that they're doing. And, we've talked to so many different coaches that have talked about, not just the basketball piece of it, but just some of the things that they've done in their communities and some of the things they've done with their players to have an impact. And can you talk a little bit about why that's so important to you as a coach, and why you've made it such an integral part of what you do?
I think it goes all the way back to the beginning of this podcast, where, I had a third grade teacher who went above and beyond what she needed to do to look out for a student that she had just met. She made the effort to call her mother and to give me the extra help. I remember there are times when she would stay after school and give me the extra help. So the fact that I turned around and became a teacher, many years later, and I taught in the classroom for 12 years is no surprise when I look back and understand that I'm a product of someone who has received much. That's one thing, to give back. I think it's a responsibility that we all should take seriously. But the other thing I really realized, learned is, you know, I had the good fortune of going through college at University of Oregon, graduated, really not knowing what I wanted to do, had been a business major, but not happy sitting in a cubicle crunching numbers. And I was fortunate to come across a brochure at the Career Center. And it was a brochure for Teach for America, a national organization that, you know, would recruit recent grads to go and serve in either rural or inner city communities for 2 years. It was a 2-year commitment. And so I applied on a whim, got in. Next thing I know, I'm, you know, just graduated, but I'm teaching a group of seventh graders in the South Bronx. And, you know, it's my first exposure from growing up in Eugene, Springfield, to being in a very diverse setting, being completely out of my comfort zone, but realizing that the game of basketball is where I was able to make a connection with these middle school students. And I, you know, that was the first time I really got to use it as a tool to recognize that there's power in, you know, in using sport to give back.
So how did you do that in your classroom? How did you bring basketball into the classroom, or did you do it on an after-school basis, or how did that work?
Right. So, you know, my long-winded answer as I was getting to is really, you know, it's one thing to have a responsibility to give back. I think it's also when you start to exercise that muscle of giving or serving, it becomes really a self-serving deal. I think that's why people like you and I go into coaching, because at the end of the day, it's the joy that we receive back from giving is, you know, it's, I think, and to some extent, it could be an addictive thing. But I, you know, the school that I was teaching at the time was a failing school in the New York City public school system. So even after my first year, I was alerted by my administration that the central office in New York City was going to phase out my school, so that the next year, my second year as a seventh grade teacher, I would move up with my eighth grade, you know, move up that class to be their eighth grade teacher, but we wouldn't receive a sixth grade classroom. So at that point, you know, we didn't really have a basketball team, but what I would do is I would use it as a carrot. We would have, you know, open gyms at, you know, on a Saturday morning. So they would have to come for tutoring for an hour. You know, I would do a little fundraiser with my, you know, friends who were working in finance and law and medicine in Manhattan, bring some donuts, bring some food, right? Basically sugar and fats, really.
There you go.
That's my favorite economics professor, Ed Whitelaw, would say that when he would hold students' study sections. Sugar and fat, he would bring donuts and, you know, and soda. So, con them in with that, and then, you know, get some extra tutoring in, and then after that it was basketball. So that was the hook. The 3 years I taught in the South Bronx was good, but at the end of those 3 years, I realized that I didn't want to just leave an inner city school situation where I'd only seen a failing school. So, I was fortunate to find a charter school that was just 4 blocks up from where I lived in Central Harlem. And I ended up teaching at a K-8 school there for 3 years, where the principal and her husband was the admin who had started this foundation, raised like $1 million to pour into the school, a K-8 school in Central Harlem, Future Leaders Institute. And so I got a chance to, you know, teach there. That was actually when I first got my first official team. My fifth and sixth year as a teacher, where I got to teach a middle school team, that was pretty good.
That's fun. Was it a big adjustment going from Oregon to New York City?
I thought it would be big, but, you know, again, as I said before, I've seen other Teach for America, you know, core members really struggle in the classroom. A lot of it at that point is, as you know, is classroom management, right?
For sure.
I had been a high school basketball player, a decent high school basketball player, so, you know, my skill set was such that I could still call out the best middle schooler on the schoolyard. And again, this is going back to my story with Meadow Park, where I learned to play on the blacktop. You know, my second day at the school, I, you know, just wander out to recess and see all the kids playing pickup ball in the schoolyard. And I was strategic. You know, I picked out the best player that I saw at the spot, and I challenged him to one-on-one. He was, you know, I'm 5'8", 140 pounds, soaking wet. This kid was an eighth grader, you know, 6'1", really athletic, long, like miniature Kevin Durant. And it was a close game, but I pulled it out. And next thing you know, as the bell's ringing, the kids are, you know, screaming, running up the hallway saying, Mr. Cho got game.
That's awesome.
Yeah. So that helped. That went a long ways. But yeah, so in that sense, you know, the sports piece, again, like I told you before, I learned from, you know, being out and, you know, playing, being a pretty decent soccer player, and all of a sudden realizing that that was a way in. It was the same thing with basketball many years later. And in some sense, you know, being the only Korean American that I, in my particular community in Springfield that I grew up in, my brother and I were the only Koreans at our elementary school. You know, when I would take the subway into Harlem or up to the South Bronx, and, you know, I was one of the very few Asian Americans in that setting, there's something that was familiar about it. Like, I had done this before. So in that sense, the transition is much smoother than I would have ever imagined.
Yeah, you were comfortable because you were comfortable being uncomfortable, as they say, you know, being in a situation where you had experienced that before, of being the only Korean American in a particular setting. So I think one of the things that strikes me here about this is that you looked for, you know, you kind of were in your element at the University of Oregon to go into business, and then now you're, you know, going into teaching. And when you got to that point, did you realize as you were starting out that part of your career that you really, that not only did you love basketball, but did you find yourself attracted to just the interaction with the kids as being a big piece of what drove you to become a teacher for Teach for America? Or was it just what was it that made you want to make that decision other than running away from the cubicle?
Right. I've been advising one of my best players in our program. He's graduating, and he's making some big decisions on what level of basketball, you know, to play at. And I find myself telling this young man that there's something special about being surrounded by other people who are pursuing a common goal, who are as committed as you are, as passionate about a particular goal. So, you know, working with younger kids part had always been, you know, I'm the oldest of three, so I'm used to bossing around people who are
younger. Right, yeah, there you go.
We're in South Korea, where it's a very patriarchal, you know, society, where you respect the name, you respect the mister, right, like the teacher. So that part came naturally to me. I think the reason I was able to stay in teaching so long was that, especially with this Teach for America organization, you know, being a business major, you know, as much as you do in terms of group work and case studies where you're coming in as a group, you're still at the end of the day kind of looking out for yourself, I think, trying to get that next promotion and, you know, trying to get that next title. What I found when I first joined this program and they sent us out in a 5-week training session to Houston, Texas, all of a sudden, for the first time in my 5 years, you know, in college, I was surrounded by other people of my other peers who were going for the same goal, common goal of trying to close the education gap, close the gap that we have between those who have and who don't have quality education. And there's something that was really inspiring about that, that again, I experienced it. And then when I find myself, you know, obviously I'm fortunate, Greg White, Greg, if you're listening, appreciate you suggesting me for this podcast. But, you know, Greg and many others, we come from the Snow Valley, Iowa, you know, basketball school camp, right? Like, we're part of coaches who, you know, thanks to Coach Showalter, Don Showalter, Jerry Slickhouse, and others who, you know, created this community of coaches who are really passionate about teaching the game. I experienced that as a teacher at the very first training session. And I think that sustained me to stay in the profession for 12 years. And now that I've transitioned to being a full-time coach, that's what I seek out now, is just finding a space where I'm surrounded and I'm working with other people who are as passionate about what I do as they are.
Yeah, I think that's a huge key to anybody having success, fulfillment. I think those two things go hand in hand. When you can surround yourself with excellence and with other people who are pursuing the same goals that you are, I think it just makes your job a lot easier, a lot more fun, and it just feeds I think the fuel that you have, again, for whatever it is, it doesn't necessarily have to be basketball as it is for you and I, but for people out there, you know, that have a passion, and for kids that have a passion, when you surround yourself by other people who have and share those dreams with you, I think that makes for, you know, just a great situation for anybody to be able to find success. And, you know, you mentioned Snow Valley, and obviously Greg was kind of the first conduit to connect us to Coach Showalter and all the other great people, including yourself, that we've been able to have a chance to talk to. And we're excited to be able to go out there this summer and experience it firsthand. But if you think about the, you know, if you think about that community of coaches, who is it that you reach out to when you have a question, when you're struggling with something? Who are some of the mentors that you look to, that you pick up the phone and call or text when you have something that's going on in your coaching profession that you have a question? Who do you reach out to?
I'm fortunate in that one of my mentors actually just lives 5 minutes from the high school here, and I also live in Lake Oswego, so we're, you know, a 10-minute drive apart. But there's a gentleman, Tony Dorado, who is the national manager for high school basketball for Nike. He's a Lake Oswego resident and, you know, a longtime coach, a Hall of Fame coach, actually, at Morrill Catholic down in the Bay Area. Came up this way and coached the LaSalle High School for a while before moving on to, you know, work at Nike. But he's been a catalyst in terms of, you know, just encouraging and moving along my, you know, helping along my high school, you know, coaching career. The story when, you know, picking up where we left off with New York City, after my 6 years, I married my wife. We had dated for a long distance for a year. And we moved to Mozambique, where she was working in a fellowship in international public health. So she was managing these, you know, projects that would roll out HIV/AIDS prevention, you know, programs. So I had a chance to live in Mozambique, Africa, for 3 years. But one of the years, after my second year, I had a chance to have a coffee meeting with Tony. I feel like I've told the story a million times, but at the time, I was coaching a lot, but I knew that I only had a year left in this country, and Connie and I were going to wrap up our time there and move back to the States. Not sure where we were going to end up, but I knew that I had a year left. I had the good fortune of meeting Tony for a coffee meeting, and I asked him, I have a year left in this country. I've been doing all these coaching. I had worked with the junior national team. I coached one of the top club teams. I started my own high school team at the American International School of Mozambique, you know, and as I'm sharing my story, I asked him, what can I do to leave the biggest impact in the year that I have left? And his challenge to me was, you have to coach the coaches with the remaining year that you have. And you and I might, I look back on that and go, that's a common sense answer. But I was so knee deep in coaching that I wasn't able to see it at the time.
Right.
But what I did was, he was gracious enough. He had just met me. But he said, if you organize a flight and a hotel, if you fundraise and figure out a way to, you know, have enough money to, you know, invite a coach, I will send you one of my Nike Elite high school coaches. This was at the end of the coffee meeting. And so I didn't know what kind of a awesome opportunity he was giving me at the time. But I did, you know, I'm a slow learner, but I came around to it. You know, I kept in touch with them over the next 6 months. And, you know, with about 4 months to go, you know, in February, I had raised enough money and figured out a way to, you know, get a flight, get a hotel. So I emailed Tony back and he says, great, I will send you Mike Jones from Dematha Catholic High School. So fast forward to June, I had set up a week-long trip for them. Tony had come out accompanying Coach Jones, and we ran a clinic. We ran clinics locally, morning and evening sessions for 5 days. I took him on a safari to South Africa, which is a whole other story on its own for another podcast. And, you know, on the second day of their trip, Coach Jones said if I ever came back to the States, he wanted me to join his coaching staff. So between Tony and Mike Jones, those guys are, if I ever come across a discouraging situation, or if I come across even something that's, that we accomplished as a group here, those two guys are the first two guys I pick up the phone and call and look up to and share those experiences with.
So when you're doing, all right, let's go back to the beginning of your time in Africa. There's so much here to dig into. When you get over there, and obviously it's your wife that's kind of the driving force to get you there in the first place. And now you get there, how do you go about even knowing where to start, how to get going, who to reach out to start getting involved with the game of basketball there in Mozambique? What's the process like?
Yeah. Well, my wife is, she's a saint. I think every coach should get used to saying that, but she's especially a saint in the sense that she didn't know she was marrying a basketball coach when she got into this agreement with me. What happened was, my last year in Harlem, the charter school I was teaching at, we won the New York City charter school championship. One of those, can't explain, Disney after school movie moments where we beat two teams that we don't have any business beating. And so after that experience, I look at the photo of that team every day in my office. Haven't had a championship since then, so I don't know what that's about. But I got the bug then. And so when we were getting married in August, prior to that, I knew that we were moving to Mozambique. It's a former Portuguese colony. I don't speak Portuguese. And so I definitely was having a crisis about what I was going to do. But at that point, I don't think I was able to articulate it to my wife, but I think I was ready to really pursue this basketball thing. But then now I'm going to the middle of nowhere in Mozambique. So one of the things I did was I found out that the NBA was hosting a Basketball Without Borders camp in Johannesburg, which was about a 5-hour bus ride from Maputo, the capital city of Mozambique. So I sent out a bunch of, emails to complete strangers. I got a lot of no's, but I got a yes from a gentleman who was in the international office, Brooks Meek. He actually happened to be a really good basketball player from the state of Washington, played D3 basketball at Lewis and Clark, which ironically is just 10-minute drive north of my high school now in Lake Oswego. So I sent him an email. I said, hey, I'm a middle school coach. I'm moving to Mozambique. Could I volunteer at this camp? And, I had about 5 rejection emails, but he wrote back and said, sure, come on down. Love to have you. You could be a volunteer junior, coach with the team. We'll set you up. So literally, I get married in August. We move to Mozambique, and we land in Mozambique. And like a week later, I say goodbye to my wife. We'd just been married, and I get on a bus from Maputo to Johannesburg, one of the most dangerous cities in the world, looking for this American school there where the NBA was hosting a camp. So Johannesburg was, has its rough spots. This is coming from a guy who lived in Harlem and taught in the South Bronx, but the American school was actually in a nicer neighborhood. So I got a chance to volunteer. I walk in and they assigned me to a rebounding and shot block station to assist Dikembe Mutombo and Manute Bol. So
nice.
So that was my first experience, into being around NBA players. The camp was a catalyst for connecting me to at the time, there was a coach from Spain who was assigned to be the women's national team coach in Mozambique. He happened to be at the camp. He said, hey, I'm going to Mozambique too. Let's connect. Next thing I know, I meet up with him back in Maputo, and he's plugging me into the local scene there. So I was off and running.
That's very cool. All right, so give me your impression of Manute Bol. I'm going to tell you my Manute Bol story after you tell me what your impressions were of Manute when you got a chance to interact with him a little bit.
Yeah, it's really moving if you know his story a little bit, obviously, how much he's given back to Sudan and all the tragedy that he had gone through. When I met him, he had just, had been in that really rough car accident. So he was standing for very few moments at a time, where then you get the full, 7'7", you know, effect of Manute Bol. But most of the times he was sitting down in a chair while we were running the stations, and occasionally he would speak up and or pull a kid over and give a word of wisdom. But I just remember him being just such a gentle soul. And a lot of the kids just, they knew who he was and they revered him just as they did with Dikembe.
Yeah, it's Manute always struck me as being somebody who was just happy to be there, maybe is the wrong way to say it, but just a very pleasant individual. So here's my Manute Bol story. Yep. My father was a professor at Cleveland State, and one day he came home from work and he said to me, he said, "Mike, you got to come down to the gym tomorrow." He goes, "You're not going to believe this." And I said, "What?" And he's like, "I'm not going to tell you." He goes, you're not going to believe it. And I go, "Okay." And at the time, I don't know, I was probably, 12, 13, something like that. And so I go down with my dad the next day. This was in the summertime, and my dad would teach a summer class. And so I went down to Cleveland State with my dad, and the way that their gym was, there was like a balcony overhang that was kind of around the side of the court. And I'm standing on this balcony with my dad, and he's like, just wait. He goes, these guys are going to be playing at, players are going to be playing at lunchtime. He's like, just wait. So we're standing there for, 5-10 minutes, waiting. And then all of a sudden, you're right down by your feet, there's Manute's head comes walking up under this balcony. And this was literally like right after he had, they had plucked him out of the Sudan. Whoever Kevin Mackey at the time, whatever the connection was, however he got to Cleveland, he had been here for very, very little time. And I could still picture him with his leg. It would be, his calf would go up and be nice and skinny. And then it'd get to his knee. And then his knee was like this ball. And then his thigh was just as skinny as his calf. Yep. And it was just, his body was just, it didn't even look human. It was unbelievable how skinny he was and how tall he was. And then, I would see him because he was at Cleveland State for probably, 7-8 months. And I used to go down there and try to sneak myself into games and stuff, and when I could, but he would always just walk around. He couldn't speak English, which was, it was kind of strange that he was enrolled in school and couldn't really speak any English, but he could say ball. So yeah, he would just walk around and he'd look at people and put his hands up and he'd just say ball, ball, ball all the time. And he just, but he always was, like I said, he just struck me as someone who was just very pleasant and just very nice, and didn't have a mean spirited bone in his body. Just always seemed like he was just a very happy person in my experience. And so, interesting, again, it's such a small world, the basketball world, that, here you are in Mozambique, and obviously, he's from the continent of Africa, but still just the fact that, again, multiple people who, the people that you get to interact with through basketball is incredible.
And as much as, you have this vivid memory of him, just imagine what he meant to those kids in Africa.
For sure.
What he represented. He was at the time, one of the very few Africans to have made it to the league. And now we have so many, professionals who are making a living because of players like Manute, Dikembe, Hakeem Olajuwon, and others who've come before him.
So what's the interest level of basketball in Mozambique in your experience? Where's the game at least in the areas where you were? Because obviously you can't speak for the entire continent of Africa, but just in terms of what you saw while you were there, and I'm assuming that you still have contacts and people that you talk to and that you interact with, what's the state of basketball in Africa as far as you are aware of at this point?
Well, for Mozambique, it's surprisingly, after soccer, I'd even venture to say it's the second most popular sport in the country. Again, I mentioned earlier, it was a socialist country for the longest time. It's still fascinating, when you would drive down the street, some of the street signs are named after, socialist communist leaders. So, you would tell the player, "Hey, let me come pick you up." And he says, "Yeah, where do you live?" I ask him, "Where do you live?" And he says, "Well, I live in the corner of Vladimir Lenin and Kim Il-sung, we're still the leader and the leader of North Korea." So, you know, that's kind of a, there's some irony there for me as a South Korean, you know, and then South Korean American picking up an African player, you know, at the corner of a, you know, where that particular intersection happens to be.
Right. But,
given that, you know, the Soviets back in the day took, you know, a lot of interest in Mozambique and Angola, which is on the other side of the continent, the two Portuguese, you know, former colonies. And so there was a lot of, they would send a lot of basketball and other gymnastics and other swimming and other, you know, athletics instructors. So what I was pleasantly surprised to find that basketball was, you know, taught at a pretty high level. The men aren't as big as some of these other countries that, you know, you have the 7-footers from Sudan or Senegal. So they're, you know, you occasionally find a 6'8 power forward or 6'7 wing, but vertically they weren't as, you know, as blessed as some of these other countries, but the fundamentals of the game, you know, have been taught pretty well. The women who don't have that kind of, you know, verticality issue, or, you know, you can play with a 6'4 center, let's say, the women have consistently been one of the top four performing countries in the continent, which is really impressive.
Head Start Basketball is proud to announce our very first summer 3-on-3 league. Why 3-on-3? You get more touches on the ball. You get more decision-making opportunities on both offense and defense. Every player is involved in the action. There's better spacing and less congestion on the court. 3-on-3 is simply a great game for player development, and it's a lot of fun. Our league is for boys and girls in grades 3 through 8, and it'll be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center on Monday nights beginning June 10th. So grab some friends and get your team registered at www.headstartbasketball.com.
If you look at the continent of Africa and you just think about the type of athlete that succeeds at the highest level of basketball, it seems like it's such an untapped area of the country, or, you know, of the world, that people, as better coaching gets in there, as the standard of living rises in Africa, that we're going to continue to see more and more, just like we've seen the influx of, you know, foreign players primarily from Europe. But I think we're going to continue to see that happening more and more from Africa as we go forward, simply because, again, the type of athlete that's going to come out of Africa, once you put some skill level behind it and you get the, you know, the type of coaching that we have elsewhere in the developed world, I think eventually we're going to see more and more African players making it over here to the United States and getting an opportunity to play. Let me ask you this. What's your best non-basketball related Africa story that you experienced while you were there?
Non-basketball? Is there such an experience?
Well, if you were on a safari, I'm assuming you weren't looking at lions and dribbling your basketball. So.
No, definitely not. Wow. That's a, you know, on the spot pinpoint any particular one. Again, just the relationships are the ones that stand out to me the most. And again, not to bring this back to like a sob story or whatnot, but, you know, I lived in the part of Mozambique where, you know, people, it's the stereotype of what you may see, right? Like if you have, you know, you turn on the TV late and there's some, you know, commercial asking for money because there's a starving child or whatnot. What I experienced wasn't to that depth, although there's pockets of, you know, Mozambique that had experienced it, whether through a flood, so now, you know, the famine that came after or whatnot. But, and again, this is sort of related in that, you know, people saw me as, you know, first they just assumed that I'm Chinese, but then after that they get to know me, they realize that I'm an American living, you know, and accompanying my wife to this place. I remember one particular young man came to my door one day. And again, if you're an expat living in that country, you know, I'm pretty independent person, but, you know, to provide for the local economy, you're supposed to hire a security guard, you're supposed to hire a housemaid and of that nature. So, this young man just came to my door. My security guard comes to me, "Hey, such and such, Jojo wants to see you." And he came up to me and said, you know, his mother was a teacher, hadn't been paid for, you know, for the last 2 months. He doesn't have any money. He hadn't had eaten for the last 3 days. So it's not something extreme where, you know, somebody's starving to death, but you know, with the infrastructure that's not as, you know, set up as we have here in the first world, you know, a young man could go for 3-4 days and not eat. So I just remember that being a very vivid moment. It was a wake up call because I was, you know, again, doing my basketball thing and thinking that, you know, it's pretty nice life, you know, and then the rare occasions when the reality of the fact that the people in that country live on less than a dollar a day, right? That I think that's the non-basketball piece of it. You know, I had come out of New York City, you know, really wrapped up my identity as an inner city teacher, and I think I, you know, in some form or fashion, maybe even made that an idolatry, and that now that's stripped away, and I'm trying to find a new identity, and in the midst of that, you know, experience, I'm finding all these people who are, you know, having a hard time on their own, not, you know, and I have the luxury to sit here and go, well, what do I want to be next?
Right.
It's next to me who hadn't eaten for 3 days. So those are the things that stand out to me more than anything. And it drives me to be the best that I can with the opportunities that I have here so that, you know, maybe I, you know, I'm praying and hoping for a chance to go back. And they just recently up in the northern region had a cyclone that just devastated a city. People are dying of cholera. You know, there's threats of malaria coming. And so there is extreme, you know, dangers of, you know, when their infrastructure is just, you know, can be so easily wiped out. But, you know, I think about my players here. I think about them as future doctors, future, you know, CEOs, future, you know, university presidents, future teachers that would, you know, I would hope that, you know, that I'm able to share the story with them as well to challenge them that, you know, they should do something with the opportunities that they're given.
So do you think that realization of just, I don't know if how lucky you are is the right way to say it, but do you think that that's one of the biggest things that you brought back with you from Africa that's had an impact on your coaching?
Yeah, you know, you're catching me in a funny spot of the season, right? I had just finished my season now.
Right.
The last of April and May. Now we're, you know, as most high school coaches do, now we're about to pour ourselves into the month of June. But reflecting on just all the success that we had on the court, I've been finding myself telling a lot of people, you can't measure my success. Like this year, we finished 24 and 5 with the best record in the state. My first year, we're 11 and 14. But I don't want somebody measuring my success based on those two records. I would hope that I've done just as good of a job, you know, mentoring the six seniors that graduated here to think about things globally, think about, you know, social justice as I've done with the three seniors that graduated my first year. So, yeah, it impacts me. You know, I think as I share my story and I'm more open to sharing about it, hopefully, I think the next step really is to, it's one thing for you and I to talk about it or somebody out there listening to this, but I think it's another thing, at least in my own community, to figure out a way to maybe take my guys out there with me so that they could see what I've seen, they can experience what I've experienced, and hopefully have their lives to change the way that mine has for the better. So
how do you try to get those experiences through to the players on your team? So, I mean, forget about for the time being how you design your X's and O's, and we'll get to that in a little bit, but how do you go about instilling some of those life lessons that you've learned, that you've taken from your diverse experiences, and try to teach those things to your kids through the game of basketball? Do you have something specific that you do, or is it more just a case of you're having conversations, you're talking throughout the season with them, both as a group and individually? How do you go about sharing what you've learned, what you've experienced with those kids to have an impact on them and their lives, and not just today, but, you know, moving forward throughout their lives?
You know, what's amazing now with technology, I mean, you and I are doing this interview on Skype. You know, the only other time I used Skype was when I was living in Mozambique and I needed FaceTime hadn't been around at the time. But it's amazing, you know, I've been able to have FaceTime conversations with my former players from DeMatha or, you know, former students from Harlem with my student or with my players. I haven't really done that with my former players from Africa, which is strange that I haven't done that yet. Now that you and I are here sitting talking.
All right, we're reintroducing you to Skype. There you go.
Yeah, I appreciate that. The first thing I'll do in June is have a Skype conference call with my former players from Mozambique. But, you know, beyond that, I think, you know, in some ways, you know, I have a lot of influence over my players because I'm their head coach. But also in other ways, I'm just their head coach, right? So if I continue to beat them down their heads with, you know, my stories of being in Mozambique and other places, I think they'll get bored. So what I've really tried hard to do this year is invite just different guest speakers of all walks of life. You know, a lot of them will be involved with sports, obviously, but, you know, one particular guest I had this year, Jesse Mart, he's a local West Lynn high school graduate, but he happened to have gone to University of Oregon at the same time I had a car accident, you know, became wheelchair bound. I had a chance to meet him while speaking at the USAB Youth Academy in LA a few years back and get to talking and find out that we're from the same area. I've had him come and speak to my guys a couple times in the last 4 years and share about his work teaching wheelchair basketball, you know, overseas. So, you know, just people who are using the game to serve others, going from the States, you know, getting out overseas and sharing, you know, their love of the game. I think a guest speaker like that has a much deeper impact than if I were to, you know, tell some story about it. So
yeah, I think it's the old adage of, you know, eventually there's some degree of tuning out your stories when you hear them over and over again, or when you're hearing from that same voice. So I think being able to bring in a speaker, I love that idea. I think it's a great way to have a message shared with your team, but that message doesn't come from you all the time, because it's just like a situation where you're parenting. And this is one of the things I found, and, you know, I know before the podcast started, we were talking a little bit about youth sports, but one of the things that I've done is, other than basketball, I've tried to drop out of coaching all my other sports for my kids, because I think they need to hear a different voice. Sometimes in basketball, I think that it was good this year. It was the first year that my son played for somebody other than me on a seventh grade middle school team. And I think it was really good for him to hear someone else's voice, because we know as parents that our kids hear us nonstop over and over and over again about everything. And then when it comes to sports, which, you know, are supposed to be fun, and then sometimes, oh God, I got to listen to dad again, you know, in this environment. And so I think with coaches and players, you sometimes run into that same thing where, when, you know, you're hearing that coach's voice so often, that I think by bringing in somebody from the outside who could be conveying the exact same message that you might have wanted to convey to them, but just is doing it in a different voice from a different perspective, I'm sure that has a big impact on your kids. I have no question about that. How many speakers do you bring in over the course of a season typically?
It's not anything that's planned out. Obviously, it also has to do with the availability of the people that, you know, I'd like to bring in. But
right,
if I look back, you know, we had 59 practices, 29 games. We probably had about 15 guest speakers.
Wow.
And so they'll come and, you know, it really varies. You know, maybe they'll come and talk for 5 minutes. It could be a local high school coach who's retired, who's won, you know, 5 state championships. But it could also be, you know, a former Division I basketball player, you know, speaking of another person from Africa. Daniel Gomez was a player who is a product of the Seed Academy in Senegal, somebody I got to meet while working Basketball Without Borders. You know, ironically, he ends up, you know, graduating as a player from Oregon State. You know, so for somebody like that to come in and share, you know, a story of how he and I first met in Africa, and we ended up still holding this friendship all these years later in Portland, Oregon, you know, that could be a 5-minute talk, but it's something that's powerful. I think it's an image that's powerful for our student, you know, our student athletes to remember. So, but then we've had, you know, Lamar Hurd, who is a local, you know, again, former basketball player who calls all our Blazer games. And he comes and talks about what being a professional, you know, day in and day out looks like. So just trying to bring a wide range of people who are using the game and furthering their own lives through it.
So you mentioned Kevin Love, obviously doing the whole donation to the strength training and things. Does he ever is he connected to the community still? Does he still come back and talk at high school? Does he come to things? I know it's kind of hard probably during the, because of the season and stuff, but do you ever see him around town or and at functions for basketball or not? Not really.
Yeah, it's hard just during the season, you know, because our calendars might not match up and his travel schedule. And obviously, being, you know, in Cleveland, you know, they only come once a year. But he comes, you know, we haven't had him speak yet, but, you know, he'll come and, you know, check out the weight room and you know, check up on, you know, one of, you know, his close friends that he went to school from here. So, you know, you know, our guys really look up to him. He means so much to this, you know, to this community in terms of the pride that we have. And you know, every time I walk into the gym, I see the you know, the Naismith Player of the Year Award trophies and the championship, you know, trophy and the banner that, you know, hangs in our gym. So, you know, he's not far from our minds. And just again, you know, it's been, 2007. So it's been 12 years since he's graduated from high school here. But, you know, journey that he's been on, the way he's been able to reshape his body and stay, you know, professional and stay in the league as long as he has is really remarkable, and, you know, we couldn't be prouder of him.
If you're a basketball coach in the greater Cleveland area and you have a passion for teaching the game and might be interested in joining the Head Start Basketball Camp coaching staff this summer, please reach out to us via email at headstartbasketball@usa.net.
All right, so when you first got the job there, what was your plan for building the type of program that you wanted to put together? What was the vision that you had when you first took the job there?
You know, we're fortunate here. One of the main draws for me was from a distance watching how our football program has been run here. Steve Corey has, you know, is our head football coach, and he's been coaching for 25, 26, you know, beyond those years. And, you know, they just actually won their second state championship this past season. But, you know, Coach Corey has done an amazing job of just fostering a sense of community, fostering a sense of identity that this is a group that will go out and represent the community. So I had heard of his, you know, tall tales many years, you know, even before coming here. So there was already a roadmap. It wasn't necessarily, you know, in basketball, but of somebody who had taken a program and cultivated, you know, an alumni base, a tradition, and, you know, and a history. So having seen, you know, what kind of influence that, you know, positive influence that he's had in the city, I thought, you know, that's something that was definitely possible to replicate with the basketball program.
So what did you have to do in order to accomplish that? What were one or two things, concrete things that you went ahead and said, okay, if we're going to have this kind of impact on the community, we need to be doing X, Y, and Z. Maybe there's one or two things on the court, one or two things off the court. How did you approach being a program or creating a program of impact?
I think, again, the biggest thing was the timing of it was such that I was able to hold a camp, you know, our summer camps in June and June. In the first 2 weeks of June, you know, once school got out. So that was really my first exposure to all the youth kids, right? Because I wouldn't see them again until the fall. But making sure that we had a really welcoming, you know, situation there where, you know, inviting those kids back out to our summer league games and you know, trying to get to know as many, you know, parents as possible through that avenue. But really, I think right now, you know, just finished our fourth year. You know, the biggest thing I think about is our journey from having been 11-14 first year to 12-13 second year to, you know, 20-6 the year after, and now 24-5. So, you know, as I've said, I said earlier, that records don't really matter. But I do think there is, you said that you used the word excellence. And I think the way we go about playing and respecting the game, you know, I think having a clear identity of how we play. Again, I touched on this earlier just because, again, Ryan Shepherd is our strength and conditioning coach. He was my first hire. I knew that from having come from the time I was at University of Portland for 2 years working for Coach Revenue, and then prior to that, 3 years at DeMatha, but two of those years overlapping with Alan Stein, I just saw the importance of a strong, you know, strength and conditioning program. And, you know, having, you know, the luxury of having a great coach like Ryan, who's super invested into our kids, But he's also someone who's a bridge to other sports because he works with our football team. He works with our lacrosse team. He works with the girls' basketball program. So really, it wasn't anything that I was wise enough to do it. I really stumbled onto hiring a strength coach who I believe, you know, in any basketball program is probably, after the head coach, the second most important coach in the program. So I stumbled onto him, but he's allowed me to, you know, he's really been a bridge for me to the other teams, other coaches, and, you know, broaden my reach in terms of the student athletes in our program that I've gotten to know.
So what is the strength and conditioning program that you guys are on? What does that look like from a standpoint of how much time are you putting in, or how much time are the kids putting in, let's say in the, you know, preseason, summer, and in season? What does I don't know if there is a typical workout, but kind of what are you guys doing on that, you know, sort of on the throughout the calendar year with your strength and conditioning program?
Yeah, I know that each state has different rules for how much on-court time the coaches are allowed to have. We're fortunate here in Oregon that, you know, typically after the season's over, you know, you have about a maybe 3-4 week long moratorium period where you can't do anything with your players, which I think is healthy. And then after that, you're given 6 weeks an hour, at least in our highest classification here, which is 6A. It's a pilot rule right now, but we're given 6 hours a week to work with our guys on the court, which is similar to what I experienced at University of Portland, where the NCAA, I believe, gave us 8 hours of work in the offseason. I think at the collegiate level, at Division I level, that's probably not enough. But at the high school level, 6 hours is, you know, plenty. But having said that, our strength and conditioning hours aren't limited. So, you know, maybe if I was super gung-ho about it, you know, I'd have them in the weight room another, you know, 6 to 8 hours a week.
right.
You know, you don't want to burn out the kids. You want to encourage multi-sport athletes. So in the springtime, we generally let them have a little break from it. You know, maybe we'll revisit it in the month of May and get them in the weight room a couple times, you know, a couple hours a week. In the summer, as we're doing our June ball, you know, we structure where, you know, we try to get our guys in a couple times a week. Maybe in the month of July, it's those who are motivated to stay within the program. You know, they'll make a plan with Coach Shepherd and do that on their own. In the fall, that's when we really, you know, if you're not a fall sport athlete, we set it up so that they get about, you know, close to 6 hours, I would say, you know, 4.5 to 5 hours of strength and conditioning work. So that, you know, we'll phase it, you know, set up a 10-week program before the start of tryouts so that they get at least, you know, 30 sessions in. So it's been a separator for us. It's been a difference maker. You know, I've heard many times over the last two seasons that, you know, boy, your guys play so physical. Boy, you guys, you know, you don't seem to get tired. And I think that's a credit to our, you know, strength coach.
I think that's something that is underrated by people who don't always understand the game, is how much value there is in being in the best possible physical condition. I know that's one of the things that whenever I'm coaching a team, and again, it could be from the youth level on up to back when I was a high school assistant coach, and it was one of the things that I believed in as a player, and it's one of the things that I believe in as a coach, that by getting yourself into the best possible condition that you can, it's such an advantage to be able to run longer than somebody else, to be able to just push beyond your limit a little bit more than the person next to you. And that has nothing to do with your basketball skill, and yet it can still be a separator. And I know that my playing career ended, you know, whatever, 25 years ago at least, if not longer, from a, you know, truly competitive standpoint. But I still look back on that and know that my physical gifts of speed and quickness and leaping ability were not very good. But what I did have was I was always in great condition, and I could just run longer. You know, my top speed might not have been as fast as somebody else's, but their top speed might have ended after 7 minutes, and my top speed could last for the entire game, and that gave me an advantage. So I think the fact that you're tapping into that through the strength and conditioning program that you have, other coaches and other people who know the game recognize that when they see a team that's in great condition and will fight till the end and keep working and outworking their opponent. I think that's something that if you know basketball, it's a lot of times easy to recognize that out on the floor.
Yeah, and it takes time. I think it's really a commitment to it. I think, you know, really we started to see the effects of it last year because I think if you and I just count back the hours that we just, you know, I went through this exercise of counting up with you. It's not that much, but and coaches out there might be shaking their heads, but if you add it up from their freshman year on to their junior senior year, you can see why, where maybe they're not, you know, for what you said, like maybe they're not even seeing that difference in their freshman sophomore year, but you're setting the foundation, you know, to be able to work harder and longer and continuing to do that. So I think that's where I would encourage coaches out there, you know, if you've done it a couple times, you know, for a couple seasons and said, well, I don't know if this makes a difference. Well, you know, what I'm considering now is our next phase of the growing this program and trying to, you know, continue to push to be the best that we're supposed to be is giving our eighth and seventh graders and incorporating a program now where they can be exposed to our weight room, you know, once or twice a week in the off season. And it, you know, again, having learned from Alan Stein at DeMatha, you know, he, you know, before coming to DeMatha, he was a Montrose Christian where he trained Kevin Durant. And we always talk about how people think, you know, strength means, like, the pre-draft workout where Kevin Durant couldn't bench a certain amount of weight and people
were right, strong. Right.
Well, that's not basketball strength. So, you know, you can be, you know, I think about this a lot. If I were to go back to Mozambique or any other, you know, place where there's no resources, there shouldn't be an excuse because you don't have a weight room. You know, a lot of the stuff that I've seen Alan do, or even our strength and conditioning coach at University of Portland, down to our current strength and conditioning coach now, a lot of it is band work. A lot of it is foam rolling, taking care of your body. A lot of it is, you know, using your own body weight. Well, for middle school kids, you don't want to rush them into the weight room, but you want to make sure, just like a good shooting technique, you want to give them good fundamentals in terms of how you squat, how you lunge, how you jump, how you land. So, you know, I think the sooner you can get your kids exposed to that, I think, you know, the better your program will be.
Yeah, I agree. And that's one of the things I'm going to circle back to the beginning of our conversation again. And I've sort of maintained this position that, you know, there's obviously been an explosion in not just basketball trainers, but also people doing speed and agility training for kids. And just like what you just described, where kids are having to learn how to land and how to jump and how to lunge. And I always tell people that I feel like I learned how to do that, like climbing my neighbor's tree and jumping off the roof of their garage and just running around the neighborhood playing tag and doing all those things that kids today just don't do those things in the same way that people who are from our era did them. And I think that it's why the strength and conditioning piece of it and that agility and that athleticism part of it is something that has become very important for kids to learn, because I don't feel like they learned it the same way that we did, which was more by just experimentation and running around and playing as a kid, because kids just don't play the same way that we did when we were younger. And so I think that piece that you just described becomes even more important, that we teach kids how to, you know, control their body and move and do things, compared to the way we grew up learning those things.
Yeah. And to even take that further, let's say, you know, maybe our time, that's not coming back, let's say, right? So what
right.
About it? Well, for me, I encourage guys to play other sports. I just think it's really important in the school of 1,200 kids that they expose them, you know, for the good of the program even, you know, but for their own good, they should be playing other sports. You know, one of my most memorable times in Mozambique was my first year living in the city was called Shai Shai. It was 3 hours north of the capital city. I'm living in this, you know, foreign country for the first time. I can't speak the language. And so I was driving myself mad and then, you know, driving my wife mad in the process. And, you know, she encouraged me to figure out a way to get out. Well, I figured out a way to build a basketball court, nail the backboard and the rim onto a big tree in our backyard. It was a dirt field, you know, and I was shooting by myself, just to, you know how that goes, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Healthy, right? I think
nothing better than nothing. There's no better place of respite than on the basketball court.
Sure. So, but what happened was a lot of the neighborhood kids saw this guy shooting hoops and said, "What's that?" You know, they had never played before. So next thing I know, my wife's coming back from a long day's work and she's got a backyard full of,
kids. Wait. I don't want to hear that ball bouncing. I want to get some rest.
I got 40 kids in my backyard. And so I taught them how to play basketball for the first time. And what was amazing about it was I still remember, it's such a memorable image. On the dirt court, you can't dribble the ball more than once or twice. And what I noticed, these kids who had never played the game before play basketball as if they were the San Antonio Spurs, because their sense of spacing from being soccer players was that you would think, and you've seen it back with our youth kids, my third grader, when somebody picks up the dribble, what do? They run straight to the ball for a handoff. Well, what the first thing I saw with these kids in Mozambique was as soon as a teammate picked up the ball, they cut into open space, just like a good soccer player would. And so it's a lesson learned thousands of miles away from here. But as a current basketball coach, if a kid comes to me if they're a youth kid, they come up to me and tell me they want to quit soccer because they want to focus on basketball, I tell that story. If they're a high school sophomore and they're thinking about quitting, I tell them that story. So play is one thing, but I think also playing other sports, there's so many benefits that you and I may not even realize.
Yeah, there really is. I've said before on the podcast that I'm a big fan of kids playing multiple sports. What I'm not a big fan of is when you get coaches and programs, and this cuts across all sports. It's not just basketball or just soccer or just football or whatever. But, what I get worried about, what I get nervous about, what I don't like is when I hear that adults who are coaches of a program or are running a private club and they're putting a pressure on, kids who are 8, 9, 10, 11 years old and their parents to make decisions and say, hey, you've got to play our sport year round and you should drop sport X just so you can play our sport all the time. And that's when you get into real dangerous territory, I think, when you're having adults trying to dictate to kids what they, what they should be doing. And the reality is that, the reason why we all get into sports in the first place is because it's fun. And that's why you pick up a basketball. That's why you kick around a soccer ball. That's why you toss the football around. And when you take that fun away from a kid and you make it more like a job when they're 10, the chances of them continuing to play that sport for the remainder of their competitive years, I think, diminishes greatly. And so I really am a big proponent for playing, again, as many sports as you can. And there are times where, like I was a kid, I think the last sport I gave up was tennis when I was in either in sixth or seventh grade. And then from then on, I just played basketball. But growing up until that point, I played so much sandlot baseball and backyard tackle football and tennis and golf, and I think it made me a better athlete. It goes back to what I said a minute ago. I think I learned how to move and do different things and understand the spacing like you described by being a multi-sport athlete. And I think if you only allow your kid to do one thing when they're 8, or you feel the pressure to have them only doing one thing when they're 10 years old, I think you're doing your kid a disservice in the long run, for sure.
Yeah, listening to you, what I take away is feeling the pressure. Who's feeling the pressure, right? Is it the parent or is it the kid? So
it's the parent. It's the parent for sure. Let's face it. I just had a conversation with the guy who my youngest daughter's in third grade, and I had a conversation with him about his daughter. They play basketball and they play soccer together on the same team. And he was talking to me last night about how when his daughter was, so this is 2 years ago, when his daughter was in first grade, that he was encouraged to have her play club soccer. And club soccer was year round and it was $1,800 a year. And, at that time she was 6 going on 7 years old. And he's like, I would never in a million years would I ever do that again. And you start thinking about that. And I just, what 6 or 7 year old, I don't care what the activity is, what 6 or 7 year old wants to do anything year round, you know, 2 hours a day, 3 times a week. I don't know any of those kids. I mean, maybe you have, there's one child prodigy somewhere in every activity that might be good for, but for 99.999% of kids, that's just a bad idea. And it costs you a lot of money too, as a parent.
Absolutely.
Let me ask you, I want to ask you about your opinion from a youth basketball standpoint about the value of 3-on-3 versus 5-on-5, and kind of get your feel for one of the things that I've been trying to sort of advocate for is playing more 3-on-3 at younger ages, simply because of what you described a minute ago with the spacing and less congestion on the court and being able to learn how to move and get into open areas and work on your game. And I think that the game of 3-on-3, if we could get more kids across the country playing 3-on-3 basketball when they're in elementary school, as opposed to playing 5-on-5 where they're spending a lot of time running up and down between the 2-3 point lines and not really having the ball in their hands, I think the skill development would be so much better from a perspective of getting kids to play more 3-on-3. Any thoughts on that?
It's ironic that you bring that up, because I just spent this past Sunday, we hosted a 3-on-3 tournament. Chris Dudley, who was a, you know, former NBA player, but also a Lake Oswego resident, he runs a foundation for his type 1 diabetes. You know, he's one who deals with type 1 diabetes, but they had a really inspiring, you know, whole Sunday's worth of 3-on-3 tournament for their foundation as a fundraiser. And in the meantime, so I have 3 seniors who don't play AAU. So they were, you know, I encouraged them to play in it, and they had a blast, you know, playing 4 games. And in the meantime, you know, just I think just across the city, there were 5-on-5 games going on everywhere throughout the city in the club scene.
Right.
And it just sitting back and seeing the amount of, I always come back to, you know, even for playing time in our youth program, or, you know, people who look at playing time, even in my high school program, I always encourage, you know, parents to look at the reps that they're getting in the 59 practices that we had, you know, that they may not see that. It's just like what I said earlier about, you know, not seeing the work, the benefit, the return on the work if you're working in the weight room your freshman, sophomore year, but you're building that foundation where you get to harvest that, you know, hard work your junior and senior year. I think it comes back to repetitions. So repetitions of the pick and roll repetitions the guys got, the screen away repetitions the guys got, the flare screen reads that the guys got, you know, playing 3-on-3. I mean, those are reps that they got in 4 3-on-3 games that maybe would take them, you know, 15 AAU games to get to. And this is not a knock on AAU or club ball. I always come back to our practices to game ratios. So 3-on-3, they're games, but really, you know, there's small-sided games that we do in our own practices a lot, 3-man game and 2-man game. I think I just listed a bunch of the benefits on the offensive end, but defensively, you know, we were one of the top defensive teams in the state, and a lot of that is, you know, based on what I learned from Coach Jones at the MAP, our weak side rotation, our commitment to doing shell drill every day, even though, you know, that might not be the most, you know, sexy thing to do in practice. When you're playing 3-on-3, you can't hide, so you have to be able to guard your yard. When you give up a straight line drive on a 3-on-3 game, there's, you know, very rarely there's weak side help. So on both ends of the floor, I think just the benefits of playing 3-on-3 is so awesome. You know, I think this past weekend, while the Hoop Summit game was going on, the USA Basketball was also hosting the national U18 tournament for 3-on-3. It's now an Olympic sport, you know, that's coming up. And so I just think the game, it's my hope that the game will continue to grow. It's my hope that the people will see the benefits of a 3-on-3, and that's, you know, maybe the closest way maybe we can, again, come to talking about, you know, our idealistic, you know, pushback towards the blacktop. But, yeah, I can't think of a better off-season activity for your players, you know, to be engaging, you know, than entering multiple 3-on-3 tournaments.
Yeah, I love the 3-on-3. So we're going to try to start a league this summer for the first time. do some for upper elementary school kids and middle school kids and see if we can't get something going and really get people to see and understand the benefits of 3-on-3. We're coming up on an hour and a half, Marshall. I want to touch on one more topic with you, just how you got involved with USA Basketball. I'll talk a little bit about some of the experiences that you've had to have there, that you've gotten to have with USA Basketball, and why it's been such a positive experience for you.
You know, I think that just, again, as a Korean American immigrant, you know, that first time you get to wear any gear, you know, where there's the flag is on there and those three letters are on there. I mean, there aren't any words to describe that, you know, that feeling of pride and gratitude. But, you know, my first time being involved was in 2012. Coach Jones was the assistant coach on the Hoop Summit team. Our senior guard, James Robinson, was the point guard. And I just got to, you know, accompany them out here, got to know, you know, some of the staff, and just been, you know, I think it's similar to my you know, I get that question a lot, you know, how did you get involved? But I think it's a lot of it is just, you know, good graces and good fortune. But, you know, some of it is also that willingness to just kind of raise your hand and say, oh, you know, I'll go there. I'll show up.
Right.
Oh, what needs to be done? And so I think it's a combination of both those things. And they've been, the people of that organization have been just so gracious to me. And I just, you know, been trying to serve as best as I can over the years.
So what are you looking forward to with USA Basketball? Do you have anything coming up on the horizon? I know Coach Jones, there was some big news that came out today about him being named the head coach of the under-16 national team. So what do you foresee, or are you doing anything with them this summer with any of the coaches' academies or anything?
Nothing. I'm not sure what's not yet. I think they're still sorting out, you know, the speaker list and all of that stuff. But, you know, fortunately, I live in Portland, Oregon, or I live in Lake Oswego, the suburb of Portland, Oregon. So every year I get to be involved with the Hoop Summit and help out. So, you know, I've been fortunate to go in the past and serve, you know, in the October mini camps. And, you know, I've been really, you know, blessed to have so many opportunities. But moving forward, I see so many new coaches now being involved with the initiative that they have in the Final Four. Coach Brost, right? He was one of your guests.
Absolutely, yes. Yep.
Bravo. Like, these are, you know, just awesome, you know, awesome human beings first, but, you know, just amazing coaches. I had a chance to learn from Coach Fitch, Scott Fitch from New York, and Stan Waterman from Delaware. I mean, those are two coaches. Coach Waterman has a court named after him, you know. So there's so many just high quality high school coaches out there that have a chance to give back to the game. I think that, you know, if somebody comes up to me and says, how'd you get involved? I think USA Basketball, you know, obviously carries a very strong brand and, you know, and represents us, you know, globally. But, you know, the best thing I've heard is from a friend of mine, Matt King, who was also your, you know, past guest, you know, who's been a speaker and has been involved with the youth academies and whatnot. And he reminds me, we're USA Basketball, you know, you're USA Basketball. I'm like, what you're doing right now is USA Basketball, you know, if you and I picked up a bag and went to Mozambique, they wouldn't know the difference. They know that you're a coach from America. You come from a place where people love the game and respect it and have something to offer. So, you know, that would be my encouragement to anybody out there. Just, you know, I think about that. Whatever the gold standard that I've been able to have, you know, I want to bring that back to our community and be able to share with the little, you know, the little circle that we have. But I think that the biggest takeaway is that we're all part of USA Basketball and we have to, you know, play our part in moving the game forward and respecting it.
Yeah, I love that. I think that if anybody who's out there who's listening, who's a coach, a parent, a player, whoever you are, if you love the game of basketball and you think about yourself representing USA Basketball whenever you go out and you interact with the game, you interact with players, you interact with fellow coaches or fellow parents, whatever it might be, if you just think about, you know, the symbolism of having that USA Basketball crest on your chest, I think the game would always be in better hands if we kind of keep that in the back of our minds. Marshall, I want to wrap it up by giving you a chance to share how people can reach out to you and get in touch with you if they'd like to, whether that's on social media, your email, and then when you're finished with that, if there's anything that we didn't hit on that you want to share for your parting shot, you can go ahead and do that as well.
Yeah, you know, I think probably the two best way to get in touch with me would be through my email. It's my full name, MarshallCho@gmail.com. And then, you know, on Twitter, you know, it's at Coach Cho. But either avenues, you know, I'm, like I said before, I've been really blessed to have, you know, so many people looking out for me. If there's anybody who wants to come watch a practice or just, you know, carry on an email conversation about the game, you know, I'd be happy to do it. I want to thank you guys for just giving me this opportunity to share my story a little bit. And just thank you guys for all you do for the game. I've listened to many of your interviews, and it's been an encouragement to me in my coaching journey.
Well, we appreciate those kind words, and we're certainly going to keep trying to plug away at our mission, which is to create a platform that helps coaches, players, parents to be able to, you know, grow the game and make it better. And that's really what it's all about, to be able to share the knowledge of all the great guests like yourself that we've been able to have on. And I think that, you know, a lot of times, especially when we're talking about high school coaches, there's people out there that are doing great things that nobody knows about. We all know about the famous people and coaches and big names in the game, but we don't always know about the people who are doing it on, I don't want to say a smaller scale, but just on a not as famous scale. And that's really what it's all about for us. So we want to thank you for spending an hour and a half with us tonight, Marshall. It's been a pleasure. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Head Start Basketball's Player Development Academy offers Cleveland area players a unique opportunity to improve their basketball skills. Regardless of a player's age, skill level, or position, training with Head Start Basketball will elevate your game to the next level. Do you want to improve your ball handling, become a better shooter, or develop into a more skilled, confident player? Our academy classes offer training that's designed to do just that. Our training sessions are innovative and will have you learning skills that are transferable to actual games. We have four different class skill levels for boys and girls, ages 4 and up. All Player Development Academy classes will be held at the Strongsville Recreation Center. For more information or to get registered, please visit www.headstartbasketball.com.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.